Joining us for this lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ is located at 1303 Evangel Drive, Huntsville, Alabama, 35816, and can be reached by phone at 256-837-8730. Worship is held every Sunday morning at 9, with Bible study following at 10:15. Evening services begin at 5 on Sunday evenings. Wednesday Bible study is held Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock.
Thank you for being here this evening. I think I would be remiss if I did not express to this congregation and a number of you who are here tonight our deepest appreciation for your kind words and your encouragement at the loss of our 15-month-old grandson. You know, it's at times like that that your faith can be tested, but it's also times like that that you realize just how close-knit God's people are, and how we are all viewing this life as something that we're going through together to reach our ultimate goal. A warm, loving congregation, we're glad that you are here tonight. Our subject is an interesting one, certainly not one that's particularly pleasant to the average Christian because of the circumstances that we are facing with regard to this religion. In our study over the weekend, we intend to cover basically three aspects of our study. And tonight we want to turn our attention specifically to who was Muhammad and what is Islam. And to answer that question, we first want to pause and think about the encroachments that are taking place in the world. Islam is on the advance. It is expanding and impacting in the world, and many Americans are surprised to find that the most populous Muslim nations on earth are not in the Middle East. Indonesia being the most populated, a bunch of islands in Southeast Asia. Pakistan used to be a part of India. So the Muslim population of the world is scattered in many places, and not as many in the Middle East as you might have suspected. If you were to take a look at the religious complexion of the world, the majority of the largest group in the world, religious group, continues to be Christian. Of course, that's a very broad concept. Anybody and everybody that claims any connection with Christianity, 1 billion of those are Catholic. There are 1 billion Hindus on the planet. And did you know that there are roughly 1 billion people on the planet that claim to be irreligious? That is, no religious connection whatsoever. Atheists, skeptics, humanists, agnostics. And then together with Buddhism and some other primal type religions, about 1 billion. That means then that Islam constitutes the second largest religion on the planet. A quick look at Islamic ethnicity. Only a quarter of Muslims are Arabic, the majority being South Central Asian, and there is a growing African-American population that is giving attention to Islam. America itself, on almost a daily basis, is manifesting indications of the encroachment of Islam into our country and our culture. Are you aware of the fact that the U.S. Post Office has produced a stamp that is dedicated to two aspects of an Islamic holiday? And then, of course, mosques are literally springing up all over the United States, from the West Coast, from California, all the way up to Washington, and then moving across the United States through the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona, moving over into Texas and Indiana, the Midwest, all the way to the East Coast and our nation's capital. Here is a Muslim mosque that is in Montgomery, and I'm confident that they are here in Huntsville as well. Interestingly enough, if you were to go back 30 to 40 years ago, you would be hard-pressed to find a mosque in our country. Do you think it's coincidental that as our civilization began in the turbulent 60s to jettison the traditional American values that characterized our nation from the beginning, do you think it's coincidental that is that coincident with that is the upsurge of many anti-American, anti-Christian ideologies and philosophies? I believe that's what's happening to our civilization. And so now well over 1,200 mosques in our nation, 2.35 million Muslims is the latest statistic that I've been able to find, 65% of whom are foreign-born. If you were to pay attention, and I'm sure you are, to newspapers and other indications, school systems are being encroached upon with Islamic teaching. And I was at the Kansas City airport not too long ago, and many of the cabbies are Muslims, and they actually installed the foot bath so that they could perform rituals prior to prayers. You know that there are a number of prestigious universities around the country that have set aside entire prayer rooms for Muslim students. You and I couldn't get them to do that for Christian students if our life depended on it. And yet adjustments being made to embrace really non-American and non-Christian thinking. Would you have ever dreamed the day would come? This is eerie to me. That thousands of Muslims would show up in front of the United States Capitol and engage in prayer from a Muslim perspective. This ought to awaken us to what is taking place in our pluralistic civilization that is literally become so open-minded that our brains have fallen out on the ground. That's basically what's happening to Americans. We bought into pluralism and diversity to the extent that we are apparently oblivious to the threat posed to our traditional way of life. So what is this religion that has become the second largest religion in the world? Well, to answer that question, you would have to go back and look at the life of Muhammad. Muhammad was born in the 6th century A.D. in Mecca. If you were to take a look at a map of that part of the world, you recognize the African continent, and there is the Arabian Peninsula circled in yellow. And notice Israel in the upper left, Iran to the far right, Iraq above there. And so Mecca is located on the eastern shore of the Red Sea, about midway down in the Arabian Peninsula. His father actually died before he was born, and his mother died when he was 6 years old. He was turned over to the care of a grandfather who died not too long after that, and then he was placed under the custody of various uncles for the rest of his childhood. He grew up like the typical Bedouin youth, tending sheep and goats and so forth. He learned the weapons of war, which at that point in history would have been a bow and a sword. He also was exposed somewhat to the outside world by means of trading expeditions that he would have been on, accompanying his kinsmen. At the age of 25, he so conducted himself in being responsible for a particular trade caravan that had been entrusted to him, he so conducted himself in a faithful and efficient manner that the owner of the trade caravan, a wealthy widow woman by the name of Khadija, offered herself in marriage to him. She was 15 years his senior, and he accepted that, and that somewhat changed his life. It gave him an opportunity to I suppose not work so hard, and he could spend more time in contemplative activities. Here's a NASA satellite photo of Mecca and environs. It's a very rugged desert part of the world. He claims that in the year AD 610, that he had gone into the mountain range near to Mecca and was, you know, there for recreation purposes, just to kind of relax and get away from the city. And he claims that he went into a cave that is situated to this day in that mountain range. in order to get out of the heat of the desert. And he claims that he was visited by the angel Gabriel, and that Gabriel gave to him orally a revelation from Allah, God, and continued to dispense revelations to him over the next 23 years of his life. All of these revelations have since been written down about two decades after his death and are now known as Al-Quran, which is Arabic for the oral recitation, the oral presentation of God's Word. Muslims claim, could not read or write. He was illiterate, and therefore he simply received these revelations orally, memorized them, and then spoke to his contemporaries. If you were to take a Quran about the size of a New Testament and spend your time reading it in an English translation, one of the first things that you would be struck by is the great emphasis that it places upon denouncing belief in many gods. Arab civilization at this time, Arab society, was very polytheistic. They believed in many gods, and so that constitutes a great deal of the subject matter of the Quran. Well, when he began articulating that concept, immediately he was brought into conflict with his hometown tribe, the Quraysh. And the main reason was they were keepers of the Kaaba. The Kaaba is a cube, a cube-like structure that is in Mecca to this day. Muslims believe that this was actually built by Adam, that it was the location that God enjoined as the place of worship. It was destroyed in the flood. They believe that God then instructed Abraham, together with his son Ishmael, who Muslims believe was the son that Abraham offered up. And the two of them rebuilt the Kaaba, and that as a matter of fact, God enjoined upon them and all thereafter to make pilgrimage to Mecca on an annual basis, or at least once during their life. But over the centuries, it became perverted in its use, and the polytheistic Arabs were using it to advance their polytheistic notion. So for him to stand up and argue, you should not be worshiping many gods, brought him into direct conflict with essentially the local economy. In the same way that in Acts chapter 19, you remember Paul denouncing idolatry, brought himself into conflict with the silversmiths, who made their living by making little silver images and selling them. Similar to this, Mecca was the place where polytheistic Arabs came from all over the peninsula in order to engage in this worship. So the local economy was directly affected by that. To denounce it would no doubt have upset a lot of people, and that's what happened. And consequently, his fellow Meccans, his hometown tribe, began to direct their animosity toward him and persecute him, especially as he began to make converts, first largely among slaves and young people. But he just gradually extended his influence, and so the hostility increased. Finally, it became so intense that it became clear that he was going to have to flee for his life. And so he did so. It so happened that there was a group of Muslims who had listened to him and believed him who lived in Medina. And so they invited him to come to their town. And there they said they would protect him and work with him. Back in those days, probably a 12-day camel ride to the north of Mecca. If you were to again look at a satellite of Medina, this is considered to be the quintessential city. Notice the focal point of this town stands out even during the day, and certainly at night, that bright white area. And interestingly enough, the reason for that is a mosque. It is called the Mosque of the Prophet, meaning Muhammad himself, because this was where he fled. In fact, Muhammad is buried beneath this green dome. And it is an incredible mosque. It's very large, covers numerous acres, and it is one of the holy sites of Islam where people will go on a regular basis, because this was where the Prophet had fled and where he actually, his life actually came to an end. Let me try to summarize for you very quickly Muhammad's life, the high points of his life, to give you some sense of who he was In the year 619, his beloved wife Kaja died. He was not a polygamist up to this point. She was the only woman he had married. And this undoubtedly was a great blow to Muhammad emotionally and mentally. He claims that later that year, he made a trip to heaven. And we'll talk about that hopefully this evening in the time that we have allotted. About a year later, he claims that he was ordered by God to marry Aisha, who was the daughter of his best friend, Abu Bakr. Aisha was 6 years old at the time. I had a Muslim challenge me on that and said, no, that's not true. I can prove that she was 18 when consummation occurred. But a number of other Muslim scholars claim that she was that young and that the marriage was finally enacted within 3 years or so of that. So, you know, you're not sure who to believe. I would want to argue about it. That's just what Muslim sources have indicated. 2 years later was that flight to Medina that I told you about, where he felt he had to leave Mecca for his life and fled to Medina to the north. And this is the year in Islamic thinking. This constitutes the central date in the Islamic calendar. You know, the Christian world dates all of human history by the birth of Christ, but not Muslims. Their calendar is based upon the Hijra, the year that Muhammad fled from Mecca. So when you look through the Quran, which is not in any order, it's jumbled, it's not sequential, it's not chronological, there will be surahs, that's their word for these individual revelations, that are clearly speaking of Meccan circumstances and then those that clearly describe what was taking place at Medina. Having fled to Medina, here is a quick summary of the rest of his life. While he was there, he had a number of military engagements with his enemies. These included the Jewish tribal groups. This is kind of odd to us to think that there were Jewish tribes living in Arabia at this time, undoubtedly due to the dispersion that had occurred largely because of the Babylonian captivity. But these Jewish tribal groups, though Jewish, were clearly Arab. I mean, they had adopted Arab ways and everything, but they were still Jewish and still clung to a semblance of Judaism. And so Muhammad presented himself to them as the logical sequel to Judaism and Christianity. He said, I'm one of the prophets in the same line of prophets that you all give homage to. I'm talking about the same God that you worship. Well, it became clear pretty quick that the Jews were not going to accept that. And so friction began, and ultimately he had to physically subdue them in order to bring them under subjection. He also had lots of armed conflicts with other Arabic tribes, including, of course, his hometown tribe. You know, the fact that he fled town didn't mean that they dropped their issues with him. They still wanted him killed. And therefore, on a number of occasions, mounted military efforts to try to go after him. And because of the way blood feuds occur in Arabic society, there were other Arab tribes that agreed with him on this. And so Muhammad literally had to defend himself on a regular basis against those who opposed him. But in the meantime, Islam was spreading. More converts were being made. And his military was growing stronger and more numerous. It was during this period that he formed a number of marriages. And every time he took another wife, he would build another room attached to the mosque that was being built in Medina at the time. In one of our final sessions, we'll talk about what the Quran teaches about marriage and polygamy. And he claims that throughout these years that he continued to receive revelations from God through the angel Gabriel. In the year AD 630, he had grown sufficiently strong that he marched on his hometown of Mecca and brought it under subjugation. He cleansed the Kaaba of all of the idols and polytheism and did some other things and then returned back to Medina. And 2 years later, he engaged in that final annual farewell pilgrimage. It's called the Greater Pilgrimage in the Quran. That is the once a year event. He went back and engaged in his last pilgrimage to Mecca, because later that year he died at the age of 62 of an unknown illness. I've never seen a Muslim indicate what he died of. They don't really know. He had, you know, like a headache and then just died. So that is a quick summary of the life of Muhammad and his relationship to Islam. Now, what's happened in the Islamic world since that time? You know, we Americans and Christians, we don't know anything about this, probably don't care. But the time has come for us to sit up and pay attention to what has gone on in another part of the world. When Muhammad died, it was agreed by all Muslims that Muhammad was the final prophet of God, that there would be no others, and that he was in fact the ultimate quintessential prophet. However, the Muslim community, once they got over the trauma of the loss of their prophet, they concluded we nevertheless must appoint a Muslim leader, a leader of the community. Now, there was a disagreement as to how you should make that determination. But that little friction that popped up early was pretty much overlooked, set aside, and Abu Bakr, Muhammad's best friend, was selected to be the community leader. He actually only lived a couple of years. The term that they typically used at this period in Arabic history was khalifa, caliph, a kind of a vice regent or deputy that kind of ruled over the nation or the Muslims. His successor, Umar, lasted for over a decade. Each one of these men carried on great military engagements, expanding Islam over into North Africa, pushing up into Persia, modern-day Iran, Turkey, expanding over toward Russia, Armenia, those areas, and over into India. All of this taking place during these early years by brute force. Uthman was his successor. He also lasted a decade or so. At this point, though, in Islamic history, this original friction over who should be the leader asserted itself and came to a head. And the Islamic community was formally and officially divided. There were those who said the successor to Muhammad should be a blood relative. These individuals became known as Shiites, from the Arabic word Shia, which means a partisan, a party to, and in this case, Ali. Ali could trace his lineage back to Muhammad, and they felt here is the person that should be the leader. The other side said, no, the community leader can be somebody selected by consent of the Muslim population. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a person who can show direct ancestry to Muhammad. They became known as Sunnis. Seems to me that the media, though you and I have heard these terms, has not explained what's going on there and how serious this division is within Islam. Ali was succeeded by his two sons, Hassan and Hussein. All of these names are familiar to us, aren't they? Muslims, you know, Americans used to name their children Bible names. Go back, you know, 50 years and before. And there were a lot more American names that came right out of the Bible. And that's less so today. Muslims continue to do that. Omar, Umar, Hussein, Hassan, Ali. These all go back to famous historical characters. The religious leaders of the Shiite community are typically known as imams. The other side of this thing, the Sunnis, and by the way, there was some major fighting that took place between these two groups, and I'm talking about major fighting, beheading and killing and so forth. And there are Muslim activities that perhaps you've seen celebrations or commemorations on the news that go back to some of these activities, some of these conflicts that occurred early. But the Sunnis, in selecting their community leader, would establish what we would call dynasties, where several leaders would come one after the other and form kind of a dynasty. They call it a caliphate, caliphs. And their leaders over the years have been known as sultans and sheikhs and caliphs. The Ottoman Empire, again, Americans are not very familiar with that, but this was considered a grand empire that made advancements in medicine and architecture and many other areas, somewhat enlightened empire. Back at the time of the founding fathers, in the early 1800s, the Muslims, the Turkish Empire, was at war with Russia, Tsarist Russia, the Russo-Turkish War. And our founders were fully aware of it and commented on it. We'll try to get to some of that toward the end of our study. For all practical purposes, the Ottoman Empire came to an end about the time of World War I. So there is a brief history of what's happened in Islam from the beginning. I cannot overemphasize the division that exists in Islam between Sunnis and Shiites. It is deep, it is intense, but do not let anyone tell you that Islam is not as fragmented and divided as Christendom is. It is. All religions are. So that's not how truth is determined. You would expect there to be perversions of things, even in Christianity. That does not mean, however, that the true form of pure New Testament Christianity cannot be ascertained. It can be. The Shiites have divided, the Sunnis have divided over the years and formed different groups and so forth. There are various schools of law that interpret the Quran somewhat differently. There's division amongst themselves. There was a fellow about 150 years ago named Wahhabi who said, you know, let's go back to the roots of Islam when it was Arabic, the Golden Age. And he advocated the jihad, warlike defense and propagation of Islam. The Saudi royal family, as I understand it, are followers of Wahhabi. If you were to take a look at the whole Islamic world, only for, let's just round this off, only about 10% are Shiites. All the rest are Sunnis. Now, what's interesting for our understanding of what's taking place in Iraq, the most populous Shiite nation on earth is Iran. Iran is almost totally Shiite. 60% of Iraq is Shiite. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, albeit a secular type Sunni. So he was literally keeping the majority population under control forcibly. Once he was taken out of the way by us, and we step in and say, hey, we want to try to help you, you know, all get along, which is almost laughable since they don't have a Christian orientation. But we want you all to kind of, you know, form a group here and have equal representation or whatever. The Shiites are saying, yeah, we got 60%. The Sunnis are saying, no, they'll kill us. And much of the violence taking place in Iraq today is not between our soldiers and the Muslim population. It's among Muslims. You have other ethnic issues with the Kurds, for example, to the north. So it's a more complicated thing than the media, it seems to me, has presented it to us. But much of it goes back to this central division that has occurred within Islam. Let's ask the question, why has there been so much animosity from the Islamic world directed against America? Why is that? I believe there are three very clear reasons. Number one, back in the Middle Ages, you know, the Middle Ages are dated 500 to 1500, 1,000 years, called the Dark Ages. And around 900, 1000, right in that time frame, there were three crusades launched by Europeans. So we're talking England, France, Germany, some of those others. Somewhere along in there, those guys got the idea, we need to go to the Holy Land, the birthplace of Christianity, and free it from the infidel. You see, by this time, Islamic incursions coming out of Arabia had gone over into Palestine and taken over. And these Crusaders got it in their mind that God would want them to go and to cleanse and get rid of all these Muslims. And what did they have on their robes? Massive white crosses. Do you know that even though 1,000 years have come and gone, much of the Muslim world still views us through those eyes? Now, America didn't even exist then. We weren't part of the Crusades. We're only 200 years old. And yet Osama bin Laden, in some of those recordings that he makes, has referred to America as a crusader. That's a buzz term with them. He's identifying us with what they have conceptualized as the Christian desire to kill Muslims and to eradicate them. Well, you and I wouldn't agree with the Crusades. True Christians would not agree with that. Didn't have anything to do with it. But it is still a factor in the thinking of many Muslims in the world. Number two, shortly after World War II, you remember there were millions of Jews that were killed by the Nazis. Many others displaced from their homelands in Poland, Germany, and some of those European countries fled and were looking for a place to light. And many countries turned them away. And they finally decided to come down to Palestine and to carve out a niche and to take possession of it with the backing of the United States, Britain, and others. Those were the two main backers in May of 1948. And I'm telling you that the people living there, it's not like this was a barren place where nobody lived. They were Palestinians. People lived there. And I'm telling you, those people and those surrounding Muslims, and by the way, when the Israelis did that, and the Palestinian peoples either stayed and put up with it or were displaced, you know, they appealed to their Muslim neighbors, you know, Jordan and Syria and all those Muslim countries. They didn't want them coming in. So this is a displaced people, many of them even living in tents. And I'm telling you, for half a century now, 60 years, there has been hatred and venom and anger. And it, in my opinion, it will never be resolved. It can't be. Any more than if somebody came in from outside the United States, came to Huntsville, Alabama, and said, hey, we're going to take this city. You all like it or lump it, get out, whatever you want to do. We're taking it. This is our land now. Imagine how we'd react to that. That's essentially, I don't want to oversimplify, but that's essentially the situation. And so American politics has been oriented now for 60 years toward the support of Israel. Why is that? Why are they strategically someone we would support? The only way I know how to answer that is, number one, we have a significant Jewish population in the United States and in strategic wealthy locations or places. A Jewish individual came up to me who attended the seminar down in Florida and said, You're creating a stereotype that all Jews are wealthy. No, I'm not. I'm just saying that Hollywood and there's some other places that have very wealthy, influential Jewish people that have a lot of clout. And there are strategic issues with regard to America and our interests and how Israel can be an ally in many ways. That's there too. And then all of that is exacerbated, it seems to me, by a sizable segment of Christendom in this country, who has bought into the premillennial notion that Israel is the chosen nation of God, that they have a right to that land. And certainly this is not the seminar, the time, or the place to discuss that and to show what the Bible teaches so clearly from Old Testament into New. We could summarize it with the last two verses of Romans 2. No one today is a Jew in God's sight. Not physically. One is a Jew, Paul said, inwardly, circumcision of the heart. The Israel of God today, Galatians 6:16, is the church of Christ. And all human beings are on level ground at the foot of the cross. We all are to be responsive in the same way. And God does not have one ethnic group that He favors above others, nor has He assigned any land to anyone else. That's really against the nature of God. All of the Jews' blessings ultimately were tied into God's redemptive scheme to bring Christ into the world. And other than that, they were not really favored beyond anyone else because God loves everybody, all ethnic groups. So that has created a situation. I'm telling you, the Islamic world hates us for this. They hate us. If our leaders were to get up tomorrow and announce to the world, we're no longer going to support Israel, there would be dancing in the streets in all Muslim countries. I don't know that it would change anything with us because they hate us for other reasons, but they possess in deep hatred, animosity toward America. Number three, most Muslims look upon the West and America being the leader of the West as a decadent, immoral civilization. They think most of our women are prostitutes. They dress like it. They're loose. We're having a national discussion about how to define marriage, they think this is a wicked part of the world. Do you disagree with any of those? Americans are more immoral than they've ever been. Our nation's going down the tubes, and it's because they're moving away from Christianity. Muslims aren't seeing that. They don't understand why. They just see it, but it's happening. And they think it's God's will for Islam to take this place over because they'll clean it up and enforce Sharia law. That's where they're coming from. But I would suggest to you this helps us to understand somewhat why there is so much animosity toward us. Now, if you were to summarize Christianity for somebody that knows nothing about Christianity, how would you do it? Talk about the central doctrines, perhaps. Certainly, you'd have to talk about Christ at length. The church, how to worship, how to become a Christian. Well, for Islam, it's really a rather easy thing to do because they themselves indicate that they have five pillars that constitute the structure of their religion. Here are those pillars, the shahadas, which are two oral testifications. La ilaha illallah, there is no God but Allah. Muhammadun Rasulallah. Muhammad is his prophet. A Muslim believes that when you make those oral confessions, that's conversion day. That's how you become a Muslim. And they continue to utter these throughout their lives. Salat. This is the prayer that is administered five times a day. We'll have more to say about that. It's preceded by a community call to prayer, ritual ablution that is very specific. And then typically the Muslim community meets on Fridays in their mosques. Number three, the Ramadan fast, which is a month-long fast. Muslims operate on a lunar calendar rather than solar as we do. And so it changes through history. During this month, you are to refrain from both food and liquid during the daylight hours. So if you get up before daylight, you can eat a big breakfast buffet, skip lunch, which Americans need to do. And then when the sun goes down, you can eat all you want. In my opinion, I don't mean to be unkind, that's further indication of a human religion. It would be like children saying, okay, we're going to start a religion, and in this religion, you eat all the donuts you want and all the candy you want. In fact, it's required. You know, that's human religion. And there are many exceptions even to this based on age, health, and so forth. But that is the Ramadan fast. Number four, the Hajj. This is the pilgrimage to Mecca that you hear so much about. And while it is true that theoretically a Muslim needs to do this one time during his lifetime, it's actually done annually by those who have the financial capability to do it. It's all directed toward this Kaaba that we talked about and how it is the spatial center of the Islamic universe where literally millions of Muslims assemble, gather, converge upon this location. And they go through various rituals, one of which is circumambulation, where they go in a counterclockwise direction together seven times encircling the Kaaba. They have some other activities, throwing stones, for example, which they believe was done by... who was Ishmael's wife, mother? Yeah, who was Egyptian, by the way. When she was trying to ward off the devil. And then finally, zakah, which is a religious tax. It amounts to about 2 or 3%, I would say, of a Muslim's income. Let me talk to you just a little bit about the masjid, the mosque. Here is the place of community worship. If you were to go to a Muslim country, you would see mosques as plentiful as church buildings in America. It's eerie. If you've ever been to one and seen how different that world is than ours. And within these mosques, let me identify for you the basic features of a mosque. The word mosque really does not apply to a building as we think of it, a church building. It's really more of a compound. They typically have an open area. So when you hear about Muslim terrorists retreating into a mosque, they're more than likely going into that open area within the structure. There are several features of the mosque that I think it would merit looking at and understanding what they are. Perhaps the most visible, the most visually stunning feature of a mosque when a mosque is built for that purpose, you know, as Muslims come to this country, they typically rent until they can muster the wherewithal to build a mosque. But when they do, you'll find these components. This is not a prayer tower as the denominational world conceives of it. They call this the minaret. It is the location from which the muezzin, the man designated in the community to call the people to prayer, this is the location where he stands in order to call them to prayer. And this goes all the way back to the very beginning. The first muezzin stood on the rooftop of houses in Medina where Muhammad was before they built these. Nowadays, they install loudspeakers, sometimes even use recordings, and so it's done without a live muezzin at that location. But this is literally done in the Islamic world every day in countries that embrace Islam, and it's done the same way. It's done in Arabic. And what the muezzin is saying is the same everywhere. It's called the adhan. And translated into to English, you've heard Allah Akbar. That's the first two lines. Allah is most great. Twice, there is no God save Allah. Twice, I testify that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. Twice, come to the prayer. Twice, come to the success. Allah is most great. No God save Allah. And he does it in kind of a sing-songy voice. I won't play you a tape of it, but if you've ever heard it, it sounds like he's just going, but he's actually mouthing these Arabic words, and those who know Arabic understand what is being said. Here is what's considered to be the most sacred site within a mosque. It is the mihrab, which is a niche that indicates the qibla. That's the Arabic word for direction. So all Muslims, as you've heard, pray toward Mecca. I wish we had time to analyze each one of these concepts. Does that sound like God? Would God designate one place on earth and require all people who want to please Him to turn and face that direction? I wish we had time to talk about that and see whether God even did that in the Old Testament, let alone today. Another feature of a mosque is the minbar, somewhat roughly analogous to a pulpit, though not really the same concept as Christians think of. It is the place, though, from which the community leader addresses the community within the mosque. Then we have the sadarvan and the practice of wudu. This is the ritual ablution that precedes the saying of prayers. A sadarvan, again, constructed differently in different places, but it's essentially a fountain where people have access to water, where they can do the ritual ablution prior to saying prayers. And again, this ritual is the same everywhere and always has been. Wash the hands three times up to the wrist, rinse the mouth three times, being careful during Ramadan not to swallow any of the water. Rinse the nostrils three times, wash the face with both hands three times, wash the right and left forearm from fingers to the elbow three times, wash the head, wash the ears, the feet up to the ankle three times, and then say the oral testification at the end. So it's a very ritualistic, do this over and over, day in and day out. Surely these prayers are the central feature of mosque worship. There are a number of positions, postures, not a single one. You know, we typically bow our heads, although the Bible indicates there are other prayer postures that have been used acceptably in God's sight, from standing to sitting to falling down on one's face to bowing, even lifting up hands of request. But this Islamic prayer is the same everywhere in a series of movements that begins from a standing position. It includes a bowing position. The one that's more visible is the prostrate, where the knees are tucked up under the chest and the forehead comes down and touches the ground. All of these indicated in the Arabic, the five times per day, indicated by Arabic as to when they are to take place. Now, let me very quickly give you a few observations about Muhammad's life before we close this evening. If I were to try to determine whether a religion is true, whether it's from God, I would not base it on what the people who claim to embrace that religion do or say. Would you? Do you want everybody on the planet that claims to be Christian to be the models of whether or not that's what Christianity is? Think of all the horrible things that have been done in the name of Christ that He does not approve of. So I would not necessarily discount Islam based upon what a human prophet did, although Muslims believe that Muhammad lived essentially perfectly. Not God, not deity, but the quintessential man. Well, here are a few things for you to consider. Number one, Muhammad personally engaged in 27 military campaigns, planned and implemented and authorized several others. I mentioned one of those Jewish tribes in Medina. When they were finally forced out of their stronghold, he sanctioned the decision that was made to behead all 900 of those Jewish men. They started in the morning and finished that dastardly deed by torchlight that night. So this is a feature of Islam that people need to face up to. Do you remember how many military engagements Jesus was involved in? How many armies He rode at the head of? Number two, the Quran teaches, and we'll talk about this in a later session, that a man may have up to four wives. Muhammad had many more than that at one time. So far as I can tell, at least 12 at once. I mentioned to you Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr. Zainab was his stepson. And I don't want to go into the detail of this, but ultimately he gave his wife to Muhammad, who accepted her as one of his wives. So polygamy was widespread. If you were to pick up a Quran and look at the last two surahs, they're very short, I think about 12 verses total. These, we are told by Muslim scholars, are the result of an incident in which a Jewish sorcerer's two daughters cast a spell on Muhammad, causing him to become deathly ill. As he lay on his bed, he suddenly saw, if I remember right, two angels who told him, here's the cause of this illness that you're experiencing. These sorceresses had taken a palm branch and wrapped around it 12 hairs from Muhammad's body. Not sure how they got them. His beard, perhaps. And as they tied these hairs around, they breathed an imprecation, a curse, condemnation of Muhammad on each one of those, and then threw it to the bottom of a dry well. And he became ill. And these angels explained to him why he was ill and said, here's how to, you know, stop this. Here's these verses from Allah. Get somebody to go and breathe or utter those verses over those knots that were tied into that stick. And when they did so, as each verse was uttered, those knots unraveled and Muhammad recovered fully from that illness. Well, you and I hear something like that and we think, man, that's fiction, fairy tale, myth. Who believes that happened? But Muslims believe it happened, and they believe that the Quran, those last two surahs in the Quran, were the antidote to those spells. Is there anybody in the Bible that believes in spells? Yeah. But God doesn't. The Bible reports a lot of superstitions and things that people engaged in, but the Bible doesn't dignify it by confirming it. Did you know that originally Muhammad did not pray toward Mecca? He urged his followers to pray toward Jerusalem. Don't have time to discuss that, but think about it. Why? And then he received a revelation when it became clear the Jews were not going to accommodate him. He received a revelation that urged him to pray toward Mecca. Surah 2 is where that's found. Well, that raises some questions. One other thing that I want to bring to your attention, then we'll close tonight. I mentioned to you that Muhammad claims that he made a trip to heaven. I do not mean by that at his death. I mean he made a trip to heaven and came back to tell about it. And Muslims believe that this occurred. Let me call your attention to this. Do you recognize this structure? The Dome of the Rock, located in Jerusalem, actually on the temple platform where Solomon's temple was located. What many Americans and Christians do not know is that this is not just another mosque. This is a very special mosque that began to be built by one of the Umayyad caliphs in 685. Let me just quickly show you the structure of it so you'll make sense of why they built this. External octagon with an inner octagon and then an inner circular arcade. Looking from the outside in, you can see that inner circular arcade, and immediately above that, well, not immediately, way up in the top of that center arcade, suddenly stopped working. There we go. Is a gold dome. That's the central point of the mosque. Well, if you get under there and look down, what you will see immediately beneath that gold dome is the reason why this mosque was constructed. It is called the Noble Rock. It is believed that this is the location from which Muhammad made his trip to heaven. And here is the story. Muhammad says that one night he was unable to sleep, so he got up and went to the Kaaba and laid back down, fell asleep, and the next thing he knew, he was being awakened. Somebody was tapping him. He said it was Gabriel, and with Gabriel was a winged heavenly creature. He did not know the species. It wasn't a horse. And this creature had a name, Burak. Not sure linguistically how that's connected to the president and whether it is or not, but it's the same sound in Arabic, Burak. He claims that Gabriel ordered him to mount this creature, which of course obediently he did. And with Gabriel standing to the side with his hand on this creature, they flew to Jerusalem, where they encountered several Old Testament prophets, Abraham, Moses, Joseph, others. He had a conversation with them. They offered him a drink. They had a bowl of milk and a bowl of wine. He wisely drank the milk. Muslims do not believe in alcohol consumption. After that discussion, he claims that he began to ascend through what the Quran calls the seven heavens. We don't have time to study that. Does the Bible speak of seven heavens? No. Three. Very clearly throughout the Bible, consistent. The Quran says there are seven. About halfway up, he encountered those same prophets that he had seen in Jerusalem. But now they appeared in their celestial state. He then continued his ascent with Burak and Gabriel through the rest of the seven heavens until he arrived at what the Quran calls the Lot tree of the uttermost end. That's the expression in the Quran. That is, this is the very presence of God Himself. He had a verbal exchange. Well, probably wasn't an exchange. God just told him, I want you and your followers to engage in 50 prayers every day. Muhammad left the presence of Allah, remounted Burak, and they began to descend through the seven heavens. But about midway down, they encountered Moses. And if I might paraphrase the discussion that ensued, Moses said, so what did God want? And he said, he wants us to pray 50 times per day. Muhammad said, you can't do that. That's too many. You need to go back and ask for a reduction. Now, if you were Muhammad and Moses told you to do that, what would you do? Well, he went back. And you know, God reduced it to 40. And when he came back down, Moses said, so what did he say? And he, 40. Moses said, that's still too many. Your people are not spiritual enough. They can't do that. You need to go back and ask for a reduction. I'm not making this up. I'm trying to be as honest and accurate as I can. This went on until finally it was reduced to 5 prayers per day. That is why, that is the reason Muslims engage in 5 prayers per day today. That's what this goes back to. You know, even that time, Moses said that's still too many. And when you think about it, it's accompanied by ritual ablution and call to prayer and all of these activities. But Muhammad said, I'm too ashamed, embarrassed to go back and ask for a further reduction. And so he left it at that, continued his descent. When he got back to Jerusalem, they flew back to Mecca. You know, in those days, it'd take a couple months by camel caravan, which they passed in the night. This is an event that Muslims believe is historically true. Let me ask 2, 3, 4, 5 questions, and then we'll close. Why would a horse need wings? You say, well, to fly. No, God doesn't need a creature to have wings to fly. There's no real evidence that even angels had wings. The seraphim perhaps, but the average angel in the Bible was in male human form, adult form. Didn't have wings. That's a modern figment of medieval paintings or whatever. So you can't help but ask that. That sounds a little bit mythological. And why would this horse have a name? And why, if you need to go into the presence of God and have an important discussion, would you go by way of Jerusalem? You know what name dropping is? And why would you meet specific individuals that you are trying to identify yourself with as a sequel to, as a prophet-like? And then I can't help but ask the question, if you had an opportunity to go into the presence of God Himself, temporarily, and then continue your life on earth, what would He talk about? Prayer? Prayer is important, isn't it? But what about the Lord's Supper? Or singing? What about husband-wife relations in the family? What about evangelism? Prayer? In Matthew chapter 17, you remember that on the Mount of Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah appeared and had a conversation with Jesus. Do you remember the topic of conversation? Luke tells us what they talked about. It was Jesus' impending atonement, sacrifice. Now, there's a topic to talk about. This doesn't ring true to me when one becomes acquainted with the God of the Bible. And a sequel to that question is, would God have enjoined 50 prayers? Almost an impossibility upon humans. Someone says, well, you know, that sounds a lot like Abraham's discussion with God about Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, if there are 50 righteous, if there are 45, if there's 40. Well, no doubt there's some connection because he was familiar with Jewish discussions, but that's not a parallel to what's going on here. This is equivalent to God saying, you have to be immersed. And someone says, well, come on, God, can't we change that? Okay, I'll let you be sprinkled. Well, can't we do? Okay. See, that's not God. God wouldn't do that. If God wanted people to pray 5 prayers per day, that's what He would enjoin upon us. If we are to do something that God wants us to do, He's not going to play games with us like that. So I can't help but question these circumstances and this event. Nevertheless, here are the 3 central sites of Islam: Mecca, where Muhammad was born, his home city; Medina, where he fled and died and was buried; and then the 3rd most holy site of Islam, city of Jerusalem. Tomorrow evening, I hope you'll be here. We're going to really turn now to the gist of this study. Here's how we decide whether Islam is true, and I don't see any other way to decide it. Is the Quran the Word of God? That settles it. How do we know Christianity is true? Only upon the basis of one thing. Because God has spoken to us through the New Testament, and it bears the attributes of inspiration. That cinches it. That proves it. So whatever it teaches, we know to be in fact true. Toward the end of our study, I hope you'll be here because we're going to talk about the central doctrines of Islam and how they relate to Christianity. And then I want to close our time together by talking about the founders of our civilization and their attitude toward Islam. See, again, we Americans are so ignorant of our founding and our past, we don't realize that the founders had a lot to say about Islam. Whether or not it would be harmful to America, or whether or not their intention was to be pluralistic and embrace all world religions and celebrate them. Oh, they spoke very directly about this. So I hope you'll be present with us at that time. Thank you so much for your attention tonight.
We hope you've enjoyed this lesson from God's Word, brought to you by the West Huntsville Church of Christ. If you would like to continue your study of God's Word with a Bible correspondence course, please contact the church office at area code 256-837-8730.